Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing, and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the very latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org. This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. You're listening to the News Roundup. The United States crossed a staggering milestone this week.
500,071 dead. That's more Americans who have died in 1 year in this pandemic than in World War I, World War II, and the Vietnam War combined. That's more lives lost to this virus than any other nation on earth.
That was President Joe Biden speaking in a somber national address on Monday. Epidemiologists say we're at a critical juncture in the fight against COVID-19. In the weeks ahead, we could crush the virus through vaccinations, mask wearing, and social distancing. Or we could see a fourth wave as new virus variants and a false sense of security wash over the United States. Let's talk about what that means for us and for the COVID relief promised by Capitol Hill. Jeff Zeleny is the Chief National Affairs Correspondent at CNN, and he joins us now. Jeff, welcome.
Hey, good morning.
Also with us, Anita Kumar, Politico's White House correspondent and associate editor. Anita, it's always great to have you.
Thanks for having me back.
And Dan Diamond covers health policy and politics at The Washington Post. Dan, thanks for being here.
Jen, thank you.
So let's start with the pandemic. The FDA could give Johnson & Johnson's vaccine an emergency use authorization as soon as today. That means shipments could go out as early as next week. Richard in Wilton Manors, Florida, wants to know, what are the requirements of emergency use versus full approval of use? Dan?
I knew you were going to ask me this one, Jen. So emergency use authorization is different in that technically it just means that you're more likely to be helping with a treatment, a vaccine, some breakthrough than not. It's supposed to be a lower threshold to clear. So when regulators are actually in the middle of an emergency, like the COVID-19 pandemic, they will be able to speed treatments, speed vaccines. I should say that the FDA under the Trump administration, given all of the scrutiny around whether there would be political pressure to rush vaccines, they built in extra review, essentially, they said, to make sure that the vaccines would not skimp on safety. And I also will add that something I heard this week from public health experts, they were urging reporters like me, officials, not to say emergency use authorization because there are some Americans who might be spooked by that and just say that government regulators have signed off. Hmm.
So what would this additional one-dose vaccine mean for getting more Americans vaccinated?
Well, I think the biggest piece is that one shot versus the two that are required with the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines that are currently available. Jen, there was an image bouncing around on social media, a Venn diagram that asked, what do Alexander Hamilton, rapper Eminem, and J&J have in common? One shot.
Oh, dear.
And if you see, I loved it. But if you've seen the musical Hamilton, you know the one-shot reference. But logistically, one shot is easier to schedule. It's easier to store. The J&J vaccine can be in refrigerators for months. The Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, there have been efforts to get freezers that will hold them, though it doesn't appear that maybe some of those freezers are quite as necessary. So there is absolutely hope that this additional vaccine with millions of doses coming will make a big difference.
Well, the Biden administration is preparing to ramp up messaging that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is hugely effective. And here's Dr. Anthony Fauci on MSNBC.
When you have a company like J&J, Janssen, that has a very good track record with pharmaceuticals, to have them come in and be in the mix with the other two is nothing but good news.
Dan, what happens if Americans start to demand they get one vaccine over another?
This has been a big debate, Jen, because the vaccine so far, the data looks a little different between them. The Pfizer and Moderna vaccines do appear to be more effective. They are built off of a different vaccine platform and technology, this mRNA breakthrough technology that seems to not just be really effective in fighting this version of COVID, but could be very easily customized to fight the variants. The J&J vaccine does appear to be somewhat less effective overall, though still preventing severe disease, hospitalization. the goal that health experts have is if you are offered a vaccine at this point, just take the one that you're offered. The faster that we all get vaccinated, the faster we should be out of this pandemic. But I understand why Americans would have questions, because we are moving into a space where there are these different options, and some people might be getting one in the state where they are, and others might be getting a different one. And that is a messaging challenge that they are trying to figure out how to overcome.
Well, White House coronavirus czar Jeffrey Zients called Johnson & Johnson's manufacturing pace disappointing. Jeff, can the administration do anything to help speed up vaccine production?
One thing they can do is through the Defense Production Act, which they have employed, and which makes it easier and requires companies to set aside other things and focus on the vaccination. So that is one thing that the administration can do. Public pressure is another thing they can do. And also, it's at the heart of the argument, or one of the pieces of the argument, for why the Biden White House is pushing this $1.9 trillion COVID relief plan, because there is a lot of money in there for vaccination rollout and other matters. So, but the main thing is through the Defense Production Act. And they are disappointed at Johnson & Johnson, but they say that they believe the company. They say that they will meet their goal just about a month later or so.
Dan, the U.S. accounts for roughly 20% of the world's known COVID-related deaths, but makes up just over 4% of the global population. Why is our death toll so high?
Well, Jen, I think there are a few reasons that date back to how walloped the United States was when the virus first started spreading last year. We didn't have testing in place, so the virus sprung up and spread without public health officials really being able to get a handle on where it was. It got into nursing homes and did tremendous damage there. And quite frankly, the United States was pretty cavalier for a long time about how we would approach this virus, whether there were messages from President Trump and some of his allies about the lack of need for masks, even mocking people wearing them, to the overall fragmented response with different states approaching the virus either more strictly or not. So even as some states at times have been very successful at containing the virus, it has popped up again and again. And we are now at a point where the United States, despite some very good progress on vaccines, still has been an outlier on the spread of the virus initially.
Well, as of today, nearly 68 million people have received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine. Moderna and Pfizer say they plan to significantly boost vaccine shipments in the coming weeks. Dan, how big of a surge in vaccinations could this bring?
It's pretty big. So Pfizer and Moderna, which as of Friday morning, those are the only two companies that have COVID vaccines that have gotten regulators okay, they have committed 140 million more doses by the end of March. They say that they've overcome some of the early manufacturing challenges, they've gotten a better handle on what it means to plan and deliver vaccines. And then there are other companies that are hopefully going to be delivering vaccines as well in the coming weeks, Johnson & Johnson, AstraZeneca potentially. So those would go to millions more Americans, and not just the high-risk populations that were prioritized at the beginning, not just people in nursing homes or health workers, but increasingly broader swaths of the population. And different states are expected to set different terms on who will be first in line as more vaccine arrives.
Now, Anita, President Biden has promised 100 million vaccinations in his first 100 days. Will he meet that target?
It certainly looks like it. I mean, he's halfway to that stated goal in that already just 1 month or 5 weeks into his presidency. So it's faster than the administration had first publicly said. He went back and forth a little bit there at the beginning, but still the pace of the, of a million vaccines a day had almost been reached by the time he took office. So it's not quite as big of a deal as he's saying. Still, it is a, this is obviously in the right direction. I mean, we're starting to really see what this means, that people are getting vaccines. And as Dan mentioned, we're about to enter a new phase in a lot of states where, people that are younger can get the vaccine, not just frontline workers, but others. And so it's really going to start, we're really going to start to see that in the month of March.
You know, Jeff, I want to circle back to something you said. You said President Biden owns this now. But I'm curious about the role individual states play. We've seen a really piecemeal approach to keeping control of the virus on a state-to-state basis. How has the relationship between this president and leadership of individual states shifted?
by all accounts, Republican and Democratic governors alike say that they are hearing more from this White House, seeing more from this White House. And one specific point, I was in Wisconsin just last week ahead of President Biden's visit there, and I was talking to some local health officials, and they say the biggest difference is there's now a three-week advance notice of how much vaccine will be coming to the state and jurisdiction. So there's more planning available. In the Trump administration, you know, there were complaints of, you know, they were really sort of flying blind here at the state level. So certainly everything is not rosy. Some states are still seeing, you know, big shortfalls in vaccines, particularly with the storm and even separately from the storm. But they are saying they're able to plan more because they're hearing more from the administration. I think there's something as basic as, you know, the briefings from the health experts, you know, three times a week at least, you are seeing the officials from the Biden administration, the COVID task force leading this. So state officials, I think, are, you know, hearing more from them. And again, we are going to see challenges. We are seeing challenges. But the open door policy of this White House with Republican governors, again, as well as Democratic governors, is just night and day different from the Trump administration, certainly.
This email from Brian came in. He says, we need to remember that the decline in COVID numbers is from horrendous to serious. Had we not had the spikes we have, the current numbers would still be terrible. Stay the course. Let's not blow it now. You're listening to the News Roundup. We'll continue our conversation in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
He was one of the most consequential architects of the civil rights movement, but you may never have heard of him.
For our Black History Month special series, Bayard Rustin, who made nonviolence part of the fight for civil rights and organized the March on Washington.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
It's the News Roundup. We're talking about the week's biggest news. Anita, what are we seeing from the Biden administration that's different from what we saw during the Trump administration, besides ramping up vaccinations?
Well, we're seeing a lot of changes. I mean, the first thing I would say is that President Biden's really talking about the coronavirus. We just played that clip from him earlier this week. It's something we didn't really see President Trump do very often, where he acknowledged the people that had died, that he talked about what needs to be done, that he's constantly wearing a mask, even though he's been vaccinated. So, you know, we're seeing a tone set from the top that's very different. He's talking to local and state officials, governors, about what they can do and how to do that better in their states. Many states have been resistant to having people stay at home, resistant to closing businesses and wearing masks and telling people to wear masks. So all of that is very different. Of course, the other thing that he's doing, and perhaps we'll talk about this a little bit more, is he's really trying to push through this coronavirus bill on Capitol Hill. And it is moving that way. That would provide money for all sorts of things, putting money directly to Americans, monies for school, money for state and local governments, all sorts of things that he thinks has been lacking last year to get things moving again.
We will talk about that package in just a bit. But Jeff, I just want us to pause on that statistic we heard from President Biden. More Americans have died in 1 year in this pandemic than in World War I, World War II, and the Vietnam War combined. How do we wrap our minds around the gravity of that milestone?
It really is difficult to do, but as Anita was saying, I mean, I think the biggest difference is we are hearing President Biden talk about it. The country saw the images of he and First Lady Jill Biden standing just outside the portico, and which was lined with lit candles as he, you know, had a moment of silence, and the Marine Band was playing Amazing Grace, and it was really just a moment, you know, to take in the gravity of this. It reminded me of being on the Mall the day before his inauguration, when there was also a memorial. So, you know, he hasn't necessarily slowed the huge death toll here. 500,000 people. We just, you know, can't say that often enough, but there are so many changes that have happened in the first 5 weeks of his presidency. And I think just the fact that he's empathetically talking about it and, you know, grieving out loud, you know, in the face of other Americans, I think that is one of the big changes here. But now, you know, if he didn't already fully own this challenge, he absolutely owns it now. And that is one of the things, you know, that really is driving this White House. But it's a big challenge for them. As you said, we are at a crossroads here. Will there be, you know, will this be the peak, or will there be sort of a slide into normalcy that will, you know, set this in the wrong direction? So this is his burden, and he realizes that.
Well, we are seeing some encouraging statistics. From late December to early February, new COVID cases among nursing home residents fell by more than 80%. Deaths in nursing homes dropped by 65%. Dan, do we know what's happening here?
Jen, I think it's a good indication that the vaccines work and work quickly. More than 4 million nursing home residents and employees have gotten at least one dose of the vaccine. About 2 million have been fully vaccinated in the two-dose regimen. The vaccines were beginning to be administered in December, so you can track a lot of that improvement back to the early vaccinations. So I think it's wonderful news, but it also speaks to how terribly the virus ravaged nursing homes last year, which have been real hotspots of the disease. One reason the decline looks so sharp is because the peak was so high. And Jen, I would say that there's also been a broader decline in new cases beyond nursing homes, but there's a slight uptick recently that really worries public health experts that maybe we're seeing the early impact of some of the variants of coronavirus make their way into the population.
Now, new research shows that a coronavirus variant in California is more transmissible and resistant to antibodies. Dan, what's the latest information on this variant?
So the California variant, and there are technically two forms, B1429 and B1427. So understand why we might say California variant instead. But this is an emerging variant of the virus that does appear to spread more easily, might end up being more severe. The data is still pretty early, Jen, but this is part of a rise that was expected. Mutations of the virus. The more people who are infected, the longer they are infected, the more that a virus, any virus, will likely change. And unfortunately, the U.S. has been like a greenhouse to grow the virus. We've given COVID ample time, ample spread, ample people to incubate the virus. So we will see more variants certainly coming that could challenge the treatments and vaccines that are already available.
Well, New York health officials are trying to tamp down a New York Times report that says a new variant is popping up in the city. And they say the Times report is based on unfinished research and, quote, not all variants are of public health concern. Anita, we also heard Dan talk about being urged not to use the term emergency use authorization. Help us understand this push and pull between news media and health officials.
Yeah, I mean, this has been going on basically from the beginning for a year now, where the administration and state governments are trying to push people to first get tested, now get vaccines, really put this material and information out there. But they also don't want to spread false information. Of course, there's going to be, like there is about every single thing, that push and pull between the government and the media. Media does reporting that's, you know, not all straight from government sources, other experts. So there is that issue. But, you know, the Biden administration came in thinking that they were going to have to do sort of a public relations push. Obviously, the Trump administration tried to do that. The Biden administration said, look, we're going to bring truth and transparency back to this administration or to the White House, and we want to get this information out there. We want to be blunt. We want to tell people the truth, and we want people to put masks on and get tested if they need it and get the vaccine when they need it. So, you know, everybody's sort of pushing in this direction, but there is some disagreement. As you mentioned, there is disagreement as we don't know a lot about this still. There are still lots of studies and information that's still coming out.
Well, Jeff, we know there's a risk a variant can evade vaccines. It hasn't happened yet, but what has the Biden administration said about their plans if it does happen in the future?
Well, it is one of the things that they obviously are watching very carefully. It's why we hear Dr. Fauci say again and again, as well as the CDC director and others, saying that is why the vaccination has to be as rapid as possible. The more people who can be vaccinated before these variants take hold, that is really their really only hope or best hope for getting ahead of this. But they realize that this is one of the variables that is indeed out of their control. So this is one of the things that worries Biden's political advisors as well as his health advisors. They are trying to stay on top of it, but in many respects, they are still at the mercy of this ever-changing virus, and that is one of the things that leads to so many unknowns inside the White House.
Dan, I want to briefly turn to a story you worked on this week. Vivek Murthy is Biden's pick for Surgeon General. He had a confirmation hearing this week, but has yet to be confirmed. You recently wrote how Murthy made millions last year consulting for private companies on coronavirus. What red flags has this raised, and what does it mean for his potential confirmation?
Dr. Murthy had been Surgeon General under the Obama administration. He was fired by President Trump very early in this past administration, became a speaker, author, consultant, was brought on by the Carnival Cruise Line business, Airbnb, the travel renting company, among other companies that turned to him last year and paid him hundreds of thousands of dollars, in total more than $2 million that he did disclose in his ethics disclosure. And Dr. Murthy, as Surgeon General, would be the nation's public health spokesperson in many ways. The idea that the public health spokesperson had been such a close consultant to companies that care a lot about what the federal government says and does on regulating cruises, regulating travel, that raised red flags with some good government folks and some doctors, too, worried about conflict of interest. I will say that Dr. Murthy, as we speak on Friday, probably end up getting confirmed. He has support from Democrats who didn't want to bring up this issue at the confirmation hearing, and there are some Republicans signaling that they might support him too.
That's Dan Diamond. He covers health policy for The Washington Post. Dan, it's always great to have you on.
Thank you, Jen.
And we're talking to CNN's Jeff Zeleny and Politico's Anita Kumar. A former security officials testified before Congress this week as part of the ongoing investigations into the Capitol insurrection. Here's part of the testimony from former Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund.
The events I witnessed on January 6th was the worst attack on law enforcement and our democracy that I've seen in my entire career. I witnessed insurgents beating police officers with fists, pipes, sticks, bats, metal barricades, and flagpoles. These criminals came prepared for war. They came with their own radio system to coordinate the attack. Based on the intelligence that we received, we planned for an increased level of violence at the Capitol and that some participants may be armed. But none of the intelligence we received predicted what actually occurred.
Anita, what stood out to you during these hearings?
Well, there were several things. I mean, it's hard to believe that this is the first time that Congress was really hearing from officials about what happened. There were a lot of unanswered questions, a lot of finger pointing, but I think there were sort of two big things that we can take from that. One is what we just heard, which is the intelligence didn't get to the right people or doesn't appear to have gotten to the right people. There was information that the FBI collected in Virginia that there was going to be an attack of some sort on the Capitol to Congress. That information went to Washington, D.C., but didn't get to the people that it needed to get to, apparently, according to what they're saying. So they weren't aware that that the attack could come to the Capitol. Of course, we all knew that there was going to be a big protest in D.C., that there could be people around. But the question was whether people would come into the Capitol. And then, of course, the other thing was this delay in getting the National Guard to help the police officers at the Capitol. The big takeaway from the hearing the other day was that the Department of Defense delayed a couple hours sending the National Guard because they were worried about the optics of having military personnel at the Capitol, how that would look. Now, we haven't heard from the Department of Defense. That's going to come next, so we don't know everything about both of these issues, but there was definitely a lot of blame on other agencies that were not represented.
Well, Jeff, we heard a lot of blame on other agencies for the breakdown in security during the riot, but I'm curious about what accountability looks like if nobody is stepping up to take responsibility.
They were clearly trying to spread the blame and the accountability around, and no one is stepping up to acknowledge it. I mean, there were some quick resignations, as we know. The chief of the Capitol Police, as well as the sergeant at arms on both the House and Senate side, immediately resigned, but that didn't do anything to bring accountability or trying to prevent this in the future. I think the biggest thing, as Anita was saying, it just shines a light on how odd the District of Columbia is. For those of us who live in Washington, we of course recognize that D.C. is not a state, so it does not have the same powers. If this were to happen in Virginia, for example, the governor could directly request the National Guard. That is not allowable in the District of Columbia. So I think it shined a light on the bureaucracy that and the multi jurisdictions. And one thing really unspoken or left unsaid, I guess, out of all of these hearings so far is the role of the White House and the fact that had this been any other protest, say an IMF protest or a Black Lives Matter protest from last summer, would it have been different? And we saw the Capitol Police Chief, the acting Capitol Police Chief, on Thursday, say she does not believe that played a role. I think it's very hard to believe, and members of Congress even find it hard to believe, that the actual context and purpose of that rally, the Trump supporters, did not play an optical role and an operational role in all of this. So I'm not sure after really a week long of hearings, several hearings this week, we've gotten to the bottom of any of this, as fencing remains around the U.S. Capitol. And these questions remain as well.
Well, and Anita, it sounds to me as if both of you are saying we're getting a lot of the what. What happened? What went wrong? But less of the why. And I'm curious if we'll be able to even get to the why if the White House is implicated.
Well, I think we're just at the beginning of this process, which, again, is hard to believe since it's late February and this happened in early January. But remember, these were the first real hearings about what happened. They brought up some other questions, right? So senators and members of Congress are going to be asking the Department of Defense some questions. They want to ask some more questions of Homeland Security and the FBI. I do think that other information will come out. But you're right. The White House has changed. The administration's changed. I don't know if that's going to be part of it. They haven't really indicated, what they want to hear from the White House, if anything. And of course, President Trump's people are generally gone. But we did see the impeachment trial. So we do know some of the pieces that related to the administration. I thought one of the most telling things from that trial, which of course President Trump was acquitted, was that some of the people that stormed the Capitol said they took their signal directly from what President Trump said when he spoke that day. And not just that day, but for the prior 2 months talking about the election, where he was talking about overturning the election. So I do think we have some information. I think that what members of Congress want now is a path forward here. So, as Jeff mentioned, there's still fencing. There's still security threats, both at the White House and on Capitol Hill. What they want is to figure out a way forward so that they do have the information that they need next time.
Jeff, just about 30 seconds here. The FBI and Pentagon officials are expected to testify next week. What will you be looking out for during those hearings?
I think just more specifically of that, basically an overnight email from the FBI warning of the danger of the danger of the threats. So that from the FBI, and still more from the Pentagon about what specifically contributed to the delay of as much as 2 hours of getting the National Guard approved to respond to the grounds of the Capitol.
We're rounding up the week's top stories. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
When the survivors of a mass shooting at a newspaper went back to work, everything was different, even email.
What if someone's sending us more death threats? Or what if somebody sends me a death threat and I don't see it, and then somebody comes and kills all my friends and it's my fault because I didn't read the email?
That's this week on the Capital Gazette series from NPR's Embedded.
Let's get back to the news roundup. Now, the nearly $2 trillion COVID relief package is still making its way through Congress, but the Senate parliamentarian dealt a near-fatal blow to one of its provisions last night. Jeff, she ruled that a provision raising the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour could not be included in the package. Why not?
This is because of the arcane process that this $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill is going through. It's called reconciliation. So that means that it is only being passed by, with the votes of the Democratic majority. So it has to be germane to the budget specifically. And the Senate parliamentarian, who's an official of the Senate, who's basically her job is the rule keeper. She's to make sure that the rules are followed. She ruled last evening, on Thursday evening, that that this could not be included. That, of course, it was expected. We've heard President Biden really say, for most of the last 3 weeks or so, that he was, supportive of the $15 minimum wage, but skeptical it would be included, because he knows the rules of the Senate. He spent 36 years in the Senate and is very familiar with this. Well, this is going to, in the short term for the White House, it is likely a good bit of news and one that they were expecting, and here's why. If the $15 minimum wage was included in this bill on the Senate side, they would really struggle to get the 50 votes needed. We've already seen Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, and Senator Kyrsten Sinema, Democrat of Arizona, say they do not believe that the federal $15 minimum wage law is right. They believe it's a burden on small businesses, so they may have voted against it. So it could have derailed this whole package. But then on the flip side, of course, it creates issues with the progressives. So when the House votes on this, expected late Friday night, probably Speaker Pelosi will be able to keep all of her Democrats in line because it is still in the House provision. But come next week and in the coming weeks, it will be an open question of how the Democratic unity holds, the Democratic coalition holds all over this minimum wage bill. But the White House is saying that, look, President Biden will put this forward as a separate bill, a standalone bill to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. We should point out, it's a lot. Small businesses complain about it. But in Florida, a state where President Trump carried, they also last year voted for the $15 minimum wage bill. So it's supported by small majorities of the public, but certainly not necessarily by Republican politicians.
Well, Anita, and I'm curious about how this further highlights the tension within the Democratic Party itself between centrist Democrats and the more progressive wing of the party.
Well, you're exactly right. You're seeing progressives basically say a couple things today that they want to push through anyway, that they're saying, well, let's just, let's not worry about what she said. Let's just try to move on and overrule her, essentially, and vote on it anyway. But you're also seeing people saying, hey, let's get rid of her. Why are we having this parliamentarian tell us what to do? I mean, the big picture here is that Democrats, particularly the progressive wing of the party, says, we have the House, we have the Senate, we have the White House. Why can't we get our policies through? Why should we have to care about these arcane rules? Why do we have the majority if we can't get what we want through? And so that's really the issue here. But we, as Jeff mentioned, we saw the White House say, look, we understand what's happening here. These are the rules and we're abiding by the rules. So there is that push and pull here, just like we thought there would be, because Democrats have such a slim majority, really in both chambers, that they're not going to be able to just push everything through. They do need to work with Republicans. And in this case, they do need to work with moderate Democrats and also follow the rules. So we're going to see this over and over again. You saw, Senator Bernie Sanders really coming out and being very upset about this and looking for other ways to go forward. And I think you're going to see that in the future, not just on this issue, but on others.
Well, and even if President Biden says we can put this in a separate bill, is there any guarantee that that plan would get support?
No, I mean, that's exactly the issue Jeff was just talking about. The real issue here is that there, all eyes are on the Senate all the time. It's a 50-50 split. And these moderates in the middle, both Democrats and Republicans, Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, Mitt Romney of Utah, Republican of Utah, and some others really control things, right? One vote either way can really change things. Of course, the Democrats have control because the vice president presides over the Senate. She, of course, is a Democrat. But they really cannot veer either way. They can't be too much to the left or too much to the right. They need to strike this middle balance. It's something Joe Biden on the campaign trail talked about, that he could bring both sides together, that he could get compromises, you know, all that sort of thing that he did when he was in the Senate. The difference now, of course, is you have this very vocal progressive wing that supported him, but wants him to do more.
Well, let's turn to some other news this week. Trump-appointed Postmaster General Louis DeJoy testified on Wednesday as President Biden set in motion plans to take back control of the U.S. Postal Service. But the hearing wasn't without tension. Here's part of what Virginia Democratic Congressman Jerry Connolly said to Ohio Republican Congressman Jim Jordan. This came after Jordan blamed Democrats for creating confusion around the election.
It was Donald Trump, the Republican nominee, who was planting the idea, aided and abetted by disruptive changes proposed by a new postmaster general and a compliant board of governors that actually eroded public confidence in the ability to vote by mail. That wasn't a Democratic narrative. That was a Republican narrative by the president of the United States and his enablers. I didn't vote to overturn an election. And I will not be lectured by people who did about partisanship.
Anita, can you give us a little more context about what's going on in this clip?
Yeah, basically this issue is, you know, the before Joe Biden came into office and last year, as President Trump, basically undermined voting by mail. There were a lot of people, a lot of Democrats that felt that this ally of President Trump's, who's the Postmaster General right now, was holding up the mail, holding up ballots, discrediting voting by mail. And they felt that this was the seed of what we saw these last few months where, you know, President Trump said the election wasn't fair and he blamed it a lot on voting by mail. He just basically said that voting by mail is not accurate. It's full of fraud that he could not prove. So what is happening here now is that we have this Trump ally who is still the Postmaster General. A board runs the board decides, not President Biden, who the Postmaster General will be. So it's the future of the post office here. It's the question of whether this man should remain, what they're going to do. Now, Jerry Connolly has been very vocal. It wasn't just this week. He's been very vocal against some Republicans who have stood with President Trump and said that the election was full of fraud. He just boiled over at this hearing. He just didn't want to take it anymore. He feels that the Postmaster General, the Postal Service, the Republicans in Congress, and President Trump all undermined the election and basically said he was sick of it.
Well, we got this message from Tia on Twitter who says, my question for today's show is, why is DeJoy still the Postmaster General? And Jeff, as Anita said, this is because the governing board of the Postal Service is actually the group that chooses the Postmaster General. Biden has nominated three Democrats to join that governing board. Briefly, can you tell us who they are?
Right. That is why, the Postmaster General does not serve directly at the president's purview. He's not a member of the cabinet. So President Biden has moved quickly to name a couple Democrats and a voting rights advocate to fill three of these four openings on the board. And one is Ron Stroman. He's a recently retired deputy postmaster general. And there's a woman, Amber McReynolds, who's the chief executive of a group called National Vote at Home Institute. And there's another person who's named, who's the former general counsel of the American Postal Workers Union. So these are all very much more aligned with the workers of the post office. So it will be the governing board will likely replace the Postmaster General at some point, but it is a process here. But no question about it, President Biden and this White House are seizing control of the governing board of the Postal Service. Now, that doesn't take away any of the challenges or problems or the fiscal issues, at the heart of all of this. Of course, that will come later.
We're talking to CNN's Jeff Zeleny and Politico's Anita Kumar, rounding up this week's news. Well, the Senate moved ahead with confirmation this week, but Biden's pick to head the Office of Management and Budget, Neera Tanden, hit a snag because of her past tweets. Anita, explain what happened with this confirmation.
Sure. Neera Tanden has been someone that's been in Democratic politics a long time. She's close to Hillary Clinton. She runs a liberal think tank in Washington, and she's on television and has tweeted quite a lot. She's tweeted a lot of criticisms of Republican members of Congress, including the Republican senators that she wants now to vote for her. Now, she has apologized for that at a hearing and said that she looks forward to working with them, but with the Senate so closely aligned, 50-50 Republicans and Democrats, she really does need to keep all the Democrats to win that confirmation. And what we saw late last week is that Joe Manchin, who I mentioned earlier, the senator, the moderate senator from West Virginia, said that he would not support her. And that was because of some of these tweets that she, some of these criticisms that she's made. Now that means, essentially what that means is she needs a Republican to back her. Now, we haven't heard from every single Republican, but we have heard from some that they are not supporting her. So her confirmation looks like it's in doubt unless she can get another or get a Republican to support her.
Now, we should say, Jeff, that the Biden administration hasn't pulled away from Neera Tanden yet. I mean, what happens if she can't get the support she needs for confirmation? What does it mean for the administration's plans?
Well, it means that they are going to be back to the drawing board of looking for a budget director, which is a very important job in any administration, but certainly now as this COVID relief bill is going through and likely will be passed. But look, as Anita said, there will be a little bit more time as the White House looks for at least one Republican senator. And all eyes are on Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, who we're told is going to meet with Neera Tanden on Monday, or at least she's scheduled to. But one thing the White House is trying to do is buy some time this week. They did not want to have a defeat in the middle of all of these negotiations on the COVID relief bill. So, you know, the spotlight was on the Neera Tanden controversy rather really than the spotlight being on all of the money inside this $1.9 trillion spending bill. So perhaps not ideal for the White House, but it's, you know, if you're going to have a controversy, probably better at being on a personnel matter than actually a matter of legislative substance here. But look, at the end of the day, most people inside the White House believe that Neera Tanden will not make it as budget director. The leading contender, I'm told, is Shalanda Young. She is nominated to be the deputy director of the OMB, has a long time of experience in the House budget process, is supported by Republicans and Democrats. So look, all administrations struggle with cabinet nominees. In fact, the Biden administration has a pretty good record so far. We saw a lot of confirmations this week, pretty bipartisan basis on energy, on ag, you know, certainly on the attorney general is going in that direction. The budget director probably will fall by the wayside. But again, I cannot even think of one administration in the last four that I've covered where they've gotten all their cabinet nominees through without a glitch.
Well, Anita, Jeff mentioned there Merrick Garland, who's up for attorney general. It seems to be taking a while to get through that confirmation process. What's your read?
Yeah, I mean, it has taken a while, and the attorney general is one of the ones that, you know, the Biden administration really wanted to push quickly and didn't happen. And part of that delay, of course, was because the Senate basically stopped these confirmations while they had President Trump's impeachment trial. So everything has gotten a bit delayed. But Merrick Garland did get have some hearings this week. You know, he got some tough questions about a variety of issues. There were some Senate Republicans who criticized him for not answering enough questions. He basically deferred on a lot of things or said he didn't know enough on a variety of things, including immigration. But a lot of them have already announced their support for him, including John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas, Tom Tillis, a Republican from North Carolina. So it does appear that he will get his vote, and probably that will be as soon as next week.
Well, Jeff, as you said, there were a lot of other confirmation hearings this week, including Deb Haaland as the Secretary of the Interior, Javier Becerra as the head of Health and Human Services. What stood out to you in those hearings?
Well, look, I think particularly Health and Human Services, which is such a frontline agency in the fight against COVID-19. There are a lot of Republican senators who simply believe he's not qualified for the position. Of course, Javier Becerra is a longtime member of Congress, has most recently been California Attorney General, came to prominence by filing dozens of lawsuits against the Trump administration. Some of his critics say, look, he's not a doctor, he's not a health expert. If we think back in recent administrations, the director of the Health and Human Services Department has not always been a doctor. In fact, we've seen governors, we've seen members of Congress. So I think a lot of it is just simply policy differences. So both of these look like they will be confirmed. But Deb Haaland, for example, this is another historic pick. When the Senate votes to confirm her, which is expected, the full Senate, again, it's not going to be huge bipartisan numbers, but Deb Haaland will be the first Native American to lead the Department of the Interior, which if you just look at the history of the country, all of what that department has done with Native lands, it is pretty remarkable here. And yes, she has some policy differences with a lot of these Republicans, but Senator Manchin said he will support her. So again, that's one indication of if he's supporting her, she's likely to be confirmed.
That's Jeff Seleny. He's CNN's national affairs correspondent. Also with us, Anita Kumar, Politico's White House correspondent and associate editor. Jeff, Anita, thanks to you both. 1A's lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cherry. He gets technical assistance from Ben Privett, Mike Kidd, and Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor, and Chris Castano is our digital producer. We'll be back with the global edition of the News Roundup in a moment.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
It's the News Roundup. We've got a lot to get to from around the world this week, starting with a significant development in the Middle East. The U.S. military carried out an airstrike targeting Iran-backed militias in Syria. It's the first known offensive military action undertaken by the Biden administration. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin updated reporters who were traveling with him on a trip to California.
We're very deliberate about our approach. We allowed and encouraged the Iraqis to investigate and develop intelligence, and that was very helpful to us in refining the target. It was my recommendation. We will respond on our timeline. And once again, we want to be sure of the connectivity and want to be sure that we had the right targets.
Let's welcome our guests. David Rennie is Beijing Bureau Chief for The Economist and joins us from the Chinese capital. From The Washington Post, we have Anne Guerin. Anne is a White House correspondent with a focus on foreign policy and national security. And Daniel Kurtz-Phelan is an editor with Foreign Affairs and the author of The China Mission, George Marshall's Unfinished War, 1945 to 1947. So, Anne, on these airstrikes, what do we know so far?
Well, Jen, as you said in your introduction, this is the first known use of force by the new President Biden. And it's really significant in a couple of ways, starting with the fact that it is taking place in the Middle East, which is a region that he has sought to downplay in terms of its strategic importance to the United States. He's much more interested in what's going to go on in China and in Asia in general, thinks that the U.S. has spent too much time sort of mucking about in wars it can't win in the Middle East. And yet here he is being drawn into a very complicated game of chess involving several different countries And the other reason it's significant is that it's taking place against the backdrop of a lot of complicated diplomacy surrounding Iran and whether or not the United States and Iran will both come back inside the 2015 nuclear deal. These are Iranian-backed militias that were attacked.
Well, Dan, we heard the Secretary of Defense talk about the help they had from Iraq. Can you explain why Baghdad would have been on board with this airstrike?
So the line that the United States is trying to walk with regard to Iraq here is very complicated. On the one hand, it wants to send a message to these Iranian-backed militias that they can't strike the United States with impunity. They can't strike U.S. forces or U.S. allied forces, including the Iraqi government forces, with impunity. But at the same time, it struck in Syria, notably not on the Iraqi side of the border, to avoid putting the Iraqi government in a tough situation. The Iraqi government, on the one hand, needs the support of the United States, but on the other hand, Iran and is its neighbor, and it needs to balance those two considerations. So while it supported the idea of sending a message to the militias, it was much more convenient for this to happen on the Syrian side of the border.
Well, David, we heard Anne allude to the sensitivity of this moment. The president gave this order as he's pursuing a diplomatic initiative with Iran to revive that 2015 nuclear agreement. Is that a circle he and the State Department can square?
It's fascinating, isn't it? Particularly as this builds on, you know, the very long history that Joe Biden has as Barack Obama's vice president, and before that as a senator, unusually interested in foreign policy in the Middle East. And there was always a kind of accusation from his critics that he was basically weak, that he, you know, he opposed the surge in Iraq in 2006, 2007, that he always wanted the Afghan war to be narrower. His defenders have always said that, no, it's that he's a realist who doesn't want America to be the world's policeman solving everything, but that he is also extremely clear that if the world doesn't have America kind of in charge, that that's a very dangerous situation. And so they're sort of pitching this as a sign of resolve in so many issues, not just in the Middle East, but if you talk to people who've spoken to the Biden administration about, you know, their approach towards China as well, that they're very, very keen to show resolve and almost to push back against that kind of the accusation of Joe Biden's critics that he is somehow soft or willing to disengage. Hmm.
And that's interesting, to show resolve, not necessarily force. Is there a distinction there?
I don't know. I mean, the Biden administration certainly does not want to be drawn into a hot conflict. So they're trying to temper this. And you heard the defense secretary there explaining that this is a measured, in the U.S. view of it, this is a measured response to a specific threat. And isn't intended to escalate beyond this current tit for tat, while sending a message to several different actors at once, chief among them, Iran. But, you know, things have a way of getting out of hand, and that is exactly the kind of fear of escalation that Biden has long warned of, involving, for example, the attack inside Iraq last year on the Iranian general Soleimani, that could easily have gotten out of hand.
So, Dan, what are some of the potential consequences of this move?
So you really need to think about it in the context of the nuclear deal negotiations that you alluded to. Iran, as the U.S. and Iran kind of circle around each other, trying to decide who's going to get back in the deal first, how the sequencing is going to work, what's going to happen after the deal is passed, whether there will be follow-on agreements that address other issues, other complaints that the United States has about Iran. Iran has at the same time been using its proxies, the Middle East, to remind the United States that it can make trouble. So you've seen lots of activity in the region that is meant to send the message that if the United States doesn't deal with Iran, it's going to see more trouble around the Middle East and even beyond the Middle East. And the U.S. response here was to say, just because we're talking about returning to the deal doesn't mean we won't use force in response to that trouble. So you have these two tracks. You have the diplomatic track, but also we'll probably see the continued tit for tat as long as that negotiation is going on.
Well, let's stay in the region, because for the first time, someone will face prison time for torturing Syrians who took to the streets and dared to defy Syria's dictator. In a landmark court case, a former member of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's security force will spend nearly 5 years in a German prison for crimes against humanity. Now, Anne, 10 years is a long time. Remind us what happened with these protests in Syria and why this verdict is such a big deal.
Yeah, this is, you know, a decade ago, the Arab Spring swept democracy movements swept across the Middle East, and Syria was the country that probably the United States paid the closest attention to before those protests spread to Egypt, in terms of being a real harbinger of change. The idea that the Assad family dynasty might fall, might be forced to at the very least give up power, share power, if not give up power entirely. And then those that revolution, those protests were crushed in Syria, in Egypt, and elsewhere. And essentially the light that had been the Arab Spring was extinguished. And since then, Syria has devolved into civil war. Assad's grip on power has continued with help from Iran, from Russia, from others. He's not going anywhere. And yet, you know, there were people who he had empowered back a decade ago to crack down on peaceful protesters and kill many of them. And here, for the first time, we have someone being held to account for that. It is a far cry from holding Bashar al-Assad himself to account for what happened a decade ago. But in the eyes of the world, it will be a significant development nonetheless.
Daniel, for a while, Syrian refugees in Germany were attempting to establish an international tribunal to punish the Syrian government for torture and other crimes against humanity. What happened there?
As Ian said, the fact that this is being hailed as a symbolic victory is in some ways an indication of how many other attempts at accountability for Assad and everything he's done within Syria have really fallen apart. There's been an attempt to, along with everything that's happened within Syria itself, there's been an attempt to bring cases at the International Criminal Court. There have been attempts to establish other criminal tribunals. Those have fallen apart, and instead they have resorted to using German courts under interesting principle that human rights advocates will hail as significant of universal jurisdiction, arguing that the German courts here do have some authority to hold these trials. But at the same time, it's a reminder of just how little accountability there has been for so much horror that's taken place on the ground in Syria over those 10 years.
So, David, with that context, is this verdict an isolated incident, or is this the beginning of some accountability for what we saw from Assad's government?
What's really interesting is if you read the reports from this court case in Germany, it's not just a kind of political drama. It was also a very human drama. Let's not forget there were a very large number of Syrian refugees who ended up in Germany after a kind of very painful journey through places like Turkey and Greece. And the reason that this former intelligence officer was on trial there, and in fact one of his bosses, a much more senior figure, is also facing much more serious charges, 58 counts of murder, and is going to go on trial in the same city, Koblenz, is that they were arrested in 2019 because in the streets of Germany, some of their alleged former victims recognized them and suddenly realized that their former torturer or the head of the intelligence service prison outside Damascus, Al-Katib, which is one of the most frightening places, was standing there in front of them. And so there was clearly, this is an extraordinary human drama as well as a political drama.
Margaret emails, we have no legitimate right to be in Syria or Iraq. It's time to get out of chronic regime change wars. Well, there's a lot of news from and about China this week. Let's start with Xi Jinping's declaration on Thursday that extreme poverty has been wiped out in China. In a speech broadcast live on state television, China's president said, quote, there is no other country that could achieve such remarkable poverty alleviation progress within such a short time. Now, David, your reporting means you get to see parts of the country far beyond the shiny block towers. Is this a claim you think is credible?
The target that China set itself is an extraordinary target, which was to eliminate extreme poverty. And let's be clear, these are very, very poor people. These are people earning less than $2.30 a day. And there were 100 million of these people still left about a decade ago. And the government did put extraordinary efforts into pulling them over that line. Now, some of that effort involved sort of forms of coercion or persuasion that would not be acceptable in many Western countries. So in a space of about 2 or 3 years, the last 10 million people, many of them were sort of from ethnic minorities living in very remote mountaintop villages, which were just declared not economically viable. And so they were moved en masse down into the valleys, into new housing complexes, outside small country towns. And I've been up to some of these poverty-stricken counties, the very poorest places in China, on a government propaganda tour late last year, and it's pretty heavy-handed. You go into these brand-new concrete apartments, every single one has an identical poster of Xi Jinping on the wall with the message literally written, be grateful to the party, listen to the party, follow the party. So that's the kind of strain for countries like America and the rest of the West, is that this is an incredible achievement. It was also incredible amounts of hard work by the Chinese people themselves, but the Communist Party is taking credit, and more than that, saying this proves that Chinese communism is superior to Western democracy, which is chaotic and does not look after the interests of its own people, and look at the mess that the West is in.
As you continue your reporting on this, what will you be watching for?
So the real question about these people is they're being moved in very large numbers and sort of basically integrated into the modern economy, taken away from subsistence agriculture, put in these big concrete housing estates. But there are an awful lot of question marks about what that's going to look like in 10, 20, 30 years' time. Because, you know, we tried this in the West. I mean, there's a lot of public housing complexes which were praised to the skies back in the day. And that geopolitical claim is also incredibly important. I think that, you know, for President Biden and other Western leaders, this is a China that is not just saying we've done well within our own borders. They're saying our model is better than the Western model, and others around the world should be studying from it. So it's a kind of, it's not just a kind of claim of having done something good inside China's borders. And there has been an extraordinary amount of lifting people out of abject poverty, but it is a kind of claim to Chinese global leadership as a model superior to Western democracy. And that's a real challenge.
Well, on Tuesday, Hong Kong's government announced that anyone running for elected office will need to be a patriot. Candidates will now be expected to swear loyalty not to their constituents, but to Beijing and the Communist Party. Dan, will this decision have any impact on Hong Kong being seen by the West as a good place to do business?
So you focused on the Chinese Communist Party's very particular definition of patriotism there. It's not the way we would use it here, but extends to things like undermining political order and indiscriminately objecting to government proposals, two of the things that are said to be unpatriotic according to the new definitions. And what this is meant to do is to get rid of one of the last vestiges of democracy in Hong Kong, the district councils, which are in part responsible for things like making sure trash is picked up and addressing other local issues, also have a role in selecting who the next leader of Hong Kong is. That means that the Hong Kong authorities and Beijing really want to get rid of the anti-Beijing lawmakers or the anti-Beijing figures who have been on the district councils. This is their tool for doing so, and it's going to mean that they can entirely control who is selected as the next leader of Hong Kong at a time when, remember, Beijing has been making these extraordinary efforts to crack down on the last vestiges of freedom in Hong Kong. This would have been shocking and unthinkable a couple of years ago, but it's the kind of thing that has really become part of this inevitable crackdown from Beijing and Hong Kong. You get routine protests from leaders in the West, from Washington and elsewhere. Beijing brushes them off, and I think there's little hope at this point of reversing it.
David, what does that mean for what life in Hong Kong is going to look like going forward?
It's a really depressing situation now. The national security law that was imposed last year has had an extraordinary chilling effect. I mean, as a journalist, people who used to be willing to talk to us, political scientists just sort of trying to analyze the situation, former protesters, lawyers who were trying to get elected to parliament to be a kind of loyal opposition, they are now utterly unwilling to talk because the law is so strict that even being accused of inviting foreign powers to interfere in Hong Kong's affairs has been used to put kind of lawyers and newspaper publishers on trial for national security crimes. We're now hearing about a curriculum rolled out for children as young as six in schools in Hong Kong to teach them about what national security is, why they should love China, love the Chinese flag, love the Chinese national anthem. They're trying to remake an entire society. And as Dan correctly says, the promise that was offered to Hong Kong when it came back from British rule of one country, two systems is being rewritten. There was an explicit promise that you just had to be loyal to China, but you didn't have to love the Communist Party. That was an explicit promise made by the Chinese back in the 1980s. That is now turned into, no, to love China is to love the Chinese Communist Party, and that is the requirement for anyone holding any public office in Hong Kong.
Well, closer to home, Canada became the latest country to declare China's persecution of Uyghurs genocide. In Parliament, Eric Duncan, he's a leading Conservative MP, said it was important for Canada to pay some attention to its southern neighbor.
Joe Biden and Donald Trump don't agree on much. So when they do, I think we owe it to take a look. The U.S. administration, the previous Trump administration, and the current Biden administration, key world leaders have agreed and said there's genocide happening in China. Full stop.
And there appears to be growing international momentum here, with more countries calling the Uyghur oppression genocide. What, if anything, will that change?
Well, we don't know yet whether it will change significant things like foreign investment and partnerships with China, but it could. The definition of genocide carries legal implications in many countries, including the United States, limiting what officials can do and who they can interact with if people are accused of genocide, which is categorized as a war crime, for example. We don't know whether it's going to go to that level. In the near term, the fact that the Canadian Parliament voted unanimously to declare the Chinese persecution of Uyghur Muslims a genocide is good news for the Biden administration, which is looking for some backing for the determination that it had also made, and which frankly put Biden out a bit on a limb. He put this directly to Xi Jinping in their first phone conversation, a two-hour one, a week and a half ago, and they spent a good bit of time on that call talking about what Biden considers to be China's poor human rights record, and this was example A. So the fact that Canada, which was also the subject of the first foreign leader visit, a Zoom visit, with Justin Trudeau this week, had signed up to that determination, gave Biden some diplomatic backing.
Well, the Uyghur issue is something that'll be top of mind for America's new ambassador to the United Nations. Linda Thomas-Greenfield will be the 31st U.S. ambassador to the U.N. And after some pushback from Senator Ted Cruz, she received strong bipartisan support in the Senate. She made a beeline for Beijing in her opening statement.
We know China is working across the UN system to drive an authoritarian agenda that stands in opposition to the founding values of the institution, American values. Their success depends on our continued withdrawal. That will not happen on my watch.
And how does Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield convince the rest of her colleagues that America, to quote the president, is back, and not just back, but a permanent fixture on the world stage, at least for the next 4 years?
Well, she's got a complicated task ahead. What she's referring to there when she says that China is working across the UN system is a Chinese strategy that like many things that China does, is really a long game. China has been involved for a decade now in trying to place its officials or those considered friendly to its agenda atop or near the top of UN organizations, some of them quite obscure, on the theory that over time, these Chinese figures or loyalists will help advance the Chinese agenda and, probably more importantly from their perspective, protect China from potential retaliation on human rights or other grounds. That's what she's referring to there. It's something that predates the Biden administration by a good bit. And to counter it, she will have to get over the lingering doubts from the era of the Trump administration that the United States wanted to be involved in these same organizations. Remember, the United States pulled back from international organizations, withdrew from the World Health Organization, withdrew from the UN Human Rights Council, made other moves that were deliberately antagonistic to these multilateral organizations that China has been using to its advantage. So she's now saying she's going to turn that on its head. It will be difficult to do.
David, briefly, before we move on from China this week, you've been writing about Taiwan, specifically whether President Xi sees this as his moment to get this democratic, pro-Western island of 24 million people under Communist Party control. What have you learned?
there's a real debate going on, mostly in the West, mostly in America, as to whether America's ability to deter China from trying to take back Taiwan by force is in good shape. It's clear that plan A for Beijing remains to lure Taiwan back, to persuade the people of Taiwan that they should become part of a communist-run China, a bit like Hong Kong, with a bit of autonomy. The fear is that Beijing is losing sort of hope that that will ever happen, that Taiwan is drifting further away, and they suspect things like, certainly during the Trump administration, the Americans were trying to sort of persuade the Taiwanese to pull further back. And it is absolutely clear that the Chinese military has been given orders for the past 20 years to become strong enough to defeat the Americans in a war over Taiwan. And the real dynamic at the moment is not that President Xi is about to attack Taiwan, because that still can't possibly be his preference if you could do it without force, because it would be an unbelievably brutal war. But there is a real doubt within the top of the administration and the rest of Washington that America has got the gap where you need it to be, that actually China is way too comfortably ahead in that deterrence game. And America needs to do some very serious work to catch up if it's going to deter China from thinking that it could use force.
Now, on Wednesday, the very first shipment of the COVID vaccine from the UN's COVAX program landed in Ghana. The country received 600,000 AstraZeneca vaccines.
This is really a historic moment. Today, we are very happy to receive the first batch of COVID-19 vaccines through the COVAX facility.
That was Anne-Claire Dufay, the UNICEF representative to Ghana, speaking from the tarmac after the shipment landed. And why was this significant?
Well, it's significant for a couple of reasons. I guess chief among them that this is the first time that this international project, the COVAX vaccine consortium, has been able to do what it was set up to do and deliver large number of vaccine doses where it's most needed and in a place where that wouldn't have been able to afford to buy that number of vaccines on the open market so quickly. The COVAX idea is that is to get rid of the free market, essentially, where rich countries can buy up the vaccines. Now, mind you, that did happen in many instances. But the COVAX idea is to more equitably spread vaccines where they're most needed, including to countries in Africa and elsewhere that would have otherwise been sort of at the back of the line.
Daniel, why is the first shipment only just arriving? Because some countries, including the U.S., have had the vaccine for months now.
That's right. You can see this in some ways as the start of the real test of the pandemic. Will truly be defeated anytime soon? Or are we going to see a truly global victory over the pandemic? Or will some nations, as Anne said, most of them relatively wealthy, declare victory within our own borders once we've vaccinated a large percentage of our population, even as swaths of the world continue to struggle? And given the risks of new variants arising, if the pandemic is still going in sub-Saharan Africa or South Asia or elsewhere, that does mean ongoing dangers to all of us. Part of the problem for COVAX so far has been vaccine supply. So as rich nations have bought up lots of doses from Moderna and Pfizer and others, there's been a real shortage of vaccines, just of shots to go to places like Ghana. But there's also been the problem of just distributing vaccines in places that have, in many cases, worse health infrastructure, fewer government resources. So just the sheer distribution is a challenge as well.
Well, Israel, a world leader in vaccination rates, has promised to share its excess vaccine with others. On Monday, U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken urged Israel to help increase access for Palestinians as well. That's according to Axios. And what's the backstory here, and how did Israel respond?
Well, Israel is being asked to step up its game in terms of distributing the vaccine beyond Israelis. Actually, Israel's done quite a good job of vaccinating its own citizens, but it's being asked as the occupying power in the West Bank and next door in Gaza to do that for Palestinians as well. The Palestinian Authority is blasting Israel for sending vaccines to other countries considered friendly to Prime Minister Netanyahu for one reason or another, including countries that had followed the U.S. lead in relocating or pledging to relocate their embassies to Jerusalem. Netanyahu had made a project of shipping vaccines to other countries in an act of vaccine diplomacy. And the Palestinians pointed out that, you know, they're right there close by, and they weren't being given the same treatment. Now Israel has actually put that vaccine diplomacy program on hold, but we have yet to see whether Netanyahu will go forward with any large-scale program to help the Palestinian Authority with its vaccination campaign.
As we catch our breath, a note that on Tuesday, everybody's favorite K-pop group made music history. BTS is now the first Korean act to star in their own episode of MTV Unplugged. Their cover of Coldplay's Fix You continues to be streamed by millions on YouTube. Let's wrap up our look at global COVID news with Boris Johnson's plan to get things under control in the UK.
With every day that goes by, this program of vaccination is creating a shield around the entire population, which means that we're now travelling on a one-way road to freedom.
The UK Prime Minister's latest vaccination plan would see most of the country back in business by June. David, what's in this new plan?
It's really interesting because you've had this terrible COVID outbreak in the UK where there was not only, you know, one of the worst death tolls, 130,000 dead, really disastrous economic collapse, but a collapse in trust in the government, and a collapse because there was a sense that Boris Johnson was running against his own kind of slightly swashbuckling instincts. Every time he wanted to be cautious, he was cautious too little, too late, then had to slap back down lockdowns. And we had this terrible variant, much more infectious, somewhat more deadly, that has really strained the health service over the winter. But there is now more trust in the UK and a real sense of a changing mood because the rollout of vaccinations has been really successful. Now, more than a quarter of the British population has had their first dose. And it's also been a big success for the National Health Service, which is one of the few national institutions that really does still enjoy tremendous trust in an otherwise very divided and unhappy country. And that sense that it's been egalitarian, that you can't buy your way with money to the front of the queue, that the NHS is kind of being sensible and organized and getting it done, I think has bought a lot of space for the British government to this, do this very, very systematic rollout between now and, as you say, June. There's going to be four steps of unlocking the country with 5 weeks between each to measure what's going on. And there is a sense of a slight change in mood where people are now willing to believe that this might be heading in the right direction.
Well, moving on to some other news, an intelligence report on the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi is expected to name Saudi Arabian Prince Mohammed bin Salman as complicit in his death. Director of National Intelligence Avril Haines said the Biden administration is preparing to release the report really any time now. And tell us more about this report. What is it and who drafted it?
Well, this is a U.S. intelligence assessment primarily led by the CIA that was completed within weeks of Jamal Khashoggi's brutal killing and dismemberment inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. And within, again, a matter of weeks, U.S. intelligence had concluded what it considered to be an airtight case that MBS, the crown prince and de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, had directed the killing, and that members of the kill team, agents who worked for MBS, had then reported back to Riyadh on what had happened. The CIA had intercepts from MBS himself talking about this in the days before the killing, and then other intercepts from the kill team later. So from their perspective, for more than two years now, there's been no mystery about what happened and who directed it. But that report, the classified version of it and the declassified version as well, were kept under wraps by the Trump administration. Biden had said on the campaign trail that he considered Saudi Arabia to be a pariah nation and that he would no longer protect MBS and the kingdom in general from world scrutiny over its human rights record. So this is one of the first actions that we see from the Biden administration where they're making good on that by presumably releasing this sometime this afternoon.
Well, Daniel, President Biden spoke to Saudi King Salman on Thursday. What do we know about that call?
So the most notable thing about that call is who it was with and how it was messaged. The Biden administration made very clear that the president was not going to speak to Crown Prince and was not going to speak to MBS, who had been really a central player in the U.S.-Saudi relationship, and instead was going to conduct his conversations and his relationship with the king. In that call, presumably there was some warning of this report that that was not divulged by either side, but Biden tried to deliver on this change in tone in the relationship. He talked about human rights. He talked about the value of the partnership, but also things that he wanted to see change in Saudi behavior. As Anne said, there's been a lot of focus on the Saudi relationship in the Biden administration so far, the pariah line from the campaign. There's been this push to recalibrate the relationship. You've seen some interesting early steps on Yemen, for example, where the U.S. stopped supporting the Saudi-led offensive against Yemen, against the Houthis in Yemen. But it is worth remembering that there are probably limits to just how much this relationship can be recalibrated. So even as you've seen this tough talk, you've seen this focus on Khashoggi's killing in a way that you did not see in the Trump administration, there still is plenty of cooperation between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. They're still, U.S. is still sending arms to Saudi Arabia, the defensive arms now. So even with all of this friction, we're likely to see a less dramatic change than you might have thought listening to Biden talk about a pariah state when he was on the campaign trail.
David, as we just heard, Biden insisted he would only speak to the 85-year-old king, not his son, the prince, Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS. What does that mean for the tone of U.S.-Saudi relations moving forward? Why sideline the prince? We know this is a stark contrast to how the Trump administration dealt with MBS.
Well, there's a kind of pendulum swinging. I think that, you know, there's a sense that American policy was became not only just a sort of as a political question, overly invested on the Saudi side in some of the big Sunni-Shia conflicts in the Middle East, but it became ridiculously too personal that you had Mohammed bin Sultan, the young crown prince, you know, exchanging WhatsApp messages, according to reporting, with Donald Trump's son-in-law, and sort of effectively running a kind of parallel foreign policy that was cutting out the entire diplomatic machinery. And I think it's part of that broader story that the Biden administration wants to send, that grown-ups are back in charge and things will be done the right way. And the head of state of the United States speaks to the head of state of Saudi Arabia, and MBS, his counterpart, is the U.S. defense secretary, because he's the Saudi defense minister, and that is going to be how it's done. But as your other panelists have said correctly, there's limits to how far people can burn their bridges with Saudi Arabia, because it is just such a vital player in the Middle East. It's somewhat similar to accusing Xi Jinping of genocide. The problem with all of these desires to kind of speak truth about bad actors on the other side of the world is that it's a rough world, and Joe Biden's promise is that he is a grown-up who knows how to cut deals and get things done in that world.
Let's turn now to the Democratic Republic of Congo. Italy's ambassador to the DRC, an Italian embassy official, and their driver were killed this week. They were traveling for humanitarian work when their convoy was attacked by armed men. David, what do we know about what happened here?
It's still really hazy. We do now have some information coming out of the Italian side. An Italian prosecutor spoke to CNN and said that it was not an execution. That had been one of the rumors going around, that it appears to be a gunfight. It's not clear whose bullets killed the ambassador and his Carabinieri bodyguard, but they both were killed by two bullets each. This is a very rough area of the world, although the specific road that they were on had been designated as safe for travel by the UN's security advisors. There are a lot of armed groups in that area. There are some armed rebel groups linked, for example, to the conflict in Rwanda. There's a lot of kidnapping in the area. So there's questions about whether this was a kidnapping that went wrong. But, you know, we're now starting to see at least some evidence that it wasn't a targeted political killing of the Italian ambassador, that potentially he was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Well, Anne, this attack follows news last week from the UN that more than 2,000 civilians were killed last year in eastern Congo. Why has this region become so dangerous?
Well, I mean, as David said, it is currently home to a number of armed groups. It is near Rwanda, which has its own set of in some cases, related problems. It is a region of Congo which is very rich in mineral resources, and a number of these armed groups are fighting over control of land that they can then use to extract minerals and sell those for very high prices, or sell the ability to extract those to other people. And then there's just there's been an escalating history there of kidnap culture, where one group kidnaps a convoy or takes hostages, and then another kidnaps the next convoy that comes down the same road. It is notable that the Italian ambassador was traveling in a UN Congo. This was a World Food Program, dedicated convoy with armed protection on its way to a feeding program. So he was out there doing his job in what the UN had determined was safe circumstances, and clearly that was not the case.
Now, Daniel, lots of other parts of the world get attention when it comes to U.S. diplomacy, but what is the U.S.'s role right now in Congo? What's their presence?
So the U.S. has been part of this very long effort to repair what has been really one of the most war-torn areas on Earth, and that's been true for a couple of decades at this point. As Anne and David pointed out, you get these spurts of violence that occasionally rise up to grab international attention when they touch a foreign official or are particularly horrific, or they destabilize other countries nearby. But as the UN report notes, there's still this ongoing cost to civilians on the ground there that most of the world doesn't pay that much attention to. The U.S. has supported this peacekeeping mission. It has presence in Kinshasa, in the capital, that has been pushing for a political transition. There's a new president that took over a couple of years ago, and there's an attempt to start to stabilize democracy in the country. But the prospects for really changing the situation on the ground have proved so resistant despite international attention over really 25 years now.
India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has renamed the world's largest cricket stadium after himself. And it's a move that stole some of the limelight before the ground's inaugural test match between India and England. And it is big. It's got enough room for 110,000 spectators. Dan, what's behind this decision?
Well, it's notable that this is the stadium where Modi and Trump were greeted by tens of thousands or more than 100,000 spectators when Trump visited India a year ago. It was a rally called Namaste Trump. And this renaming is the sort of thing that made Donald Trump so enthralled by and probably even envious of leaders like Narendra Modi. This is the world's biggest cricket stadium, as you said. And it's renamed after Modi, who was the chief minister. He got his political start in the state of Gujarat, where this stadium is located. And this was really one of his pet projects during his time of chief minister. So it's in some ways recognition of that, but is also really a testament to, the force of personality and the presence that he has. That's was something that Donald Trump, when he visited, was very attracted to.
And do you see any red flags here? Convention would dictate that this is something that happens after you die, not when you're still in office.
Well, Narendra Modi has made a more than 5-year project of breaking conventions like that. I mean, recall that, as Dan said, he got his start as a nationalist, a Hindu nationalist leader in this part of the country. This wasn't the first thing he's named after himself, and probably won't be the last. But he's going big here. He's making a statement about his longevity in office and the fact that he has, in some cases, remade that office around himself in nationalist fashion.
I'm wondering, David, is this also a distraction for Modi from the farm protests we've been seeing?
Certainly, he's been under pressure because you do still have these very dramatic scenes, on the very edges of Delhi with these farm processes opposing a botched agricultural reform. And so, but this is, I think, if you were asking about the red flags, I do think that if you're sitting in America wondering, beyond the fact that it's kind of funny, why should we care? Well, India is the world's largest democracy. And you hear many leaders, including President Biden, talking about how if we're going to push back against autocrats around the world, there's going to be an alliance of democracies. But India is a democracy in a lot of trouble. The normal checks and balances, a sort of reliable, reasonable, viable opposition just is not there. And when you see some of the sycophantic comments from people like the president of India, some government ministers saying that, of course, this had to be named after the prime minister because it was his dream project, that's not a system where checks and balances are working well. And that shows us that India, it's really, really troubling to have to rely on India as a bulwark against democracy in this bad world where autocracies and democracies are locked in a really scary conflict.
So what does this mean for the Biden relationship with India? Are we getting any indication of how they plan to approach this country diplomatically?
India has been, the Modi government has been a real crisis for America back to the Obama days. Remember that for a long time, Narendra Modi was sanctioned. He was not allowed to visit the United States because he was accused of having incited racist riots against Muslims as the chief minister of his state of Gujarat. But then he won this convincing victory and now further convincing victories as the Indian prime minister. And so America, along with others, is forced to deal with him. But it is another one of these examples where, you know, President Biden, this extremely experienced foreign policy president who knows all of this unhappy history, who doesn't have that same fascination that Dan mentioned during the Trump days of being dazzled by these strong men. He's in a world of strong men and he's going to have to deal with them, but it's going to test all of his commitment, his stated commitment to putting values and human rights at the front of American foreign policy.
That's David Rennie. He's Beijing Bureau Chief for The Economist. Also with us, Anne Guerin from The Washington Post and Daniel Kurtz-Phelan, Editor of Foreign Affairs. David and Daniel, thanks so much for speaking with us. 1A's managing producer is Paige Osborne. Jake Cherry is our sound designer and engineer. And our thanks to Mike Kidd, who has been on board this week, and to Barb Anguiano, who produces our podcast. Also, thanks to you for all your questions and comments over the week. You can always connect with us on Twitter at 1A, on our Facebook page, or by email at 1A@WAMU.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Have a great weekend, stay safe, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.